Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What is up, all you radical people? Are you staying sane amongst the coronavirus craziness? Is the zombie apocalypse upon us? I'm getting a little stir crazy myself here in San Diego, but I'm hanging in there as much as possible. I'm sure you guys all know this, but just in case, I wrote a book. It is called The Carnivore Code, and I'm really proud of it, and I worked really hard on it. You can check it out at thecarnivorecodebook.com. There is so much in there that is amazing, and I think you will all really love it. If you have checked out the book, thank you so much for your support. I would so appreciate a review on Amazon. It is crushing it. There are like 280 reviews. It is a 5-star book, and it is a bestseller on Amazon already. So please check out my book, The Carnivore Code, thecarnivorecodebook.com. You guys can sign up for my newsletter at carnivoremd.com and get pretty much weekly, almost weekly updates on what is going on with me, interesting articles. I sent out a whole bunch of stuff this week in the newsletter, which is called The Fundamental Health Insider, about the coronavirus, all my thoughts. I did a podcast last week about the coronavirus, and then I did a bunch of videos this week breaking down the podcast into snippets. It's all there in the Fundamental Health Insider. You can sign up at carnivoremd.com. That's my website. All right, you guys, this was a really fun conversation with my man, the myth, the legend, Ben Greenfield. He was on a walk outside of his home in Spokane, Washington. So at times there is some background noise from the wind, but this is what we're dealing with right now in the midst of lockdowns and sheltering at home and quarantine. So I was grateful that Ben could jump on. There's video associated with this on YouTube, and we had a fun conversation. We talked about all kinds of things. At the beginning of the podcast, Ben gives us some breathing exercises to cope with the excessive sympathetic state that many of us are experiencing now, the excessive fight or flight activation. And then we get into all kinds of fun topics, survival of the fittest, Native Americans in Ben's area and areas that I've been, peptides, all kinds of cool things, protein to fat ratios, human biochemistry. This is an amazing episode. Ben is an amazing fellow. And Ben also wrote an amazing book called Boundless. The website is boundlessbook.com, and as Ben mentions in the narrative of the book, many New York publishing houses turned him down for this because it was too comprehensive, because it was too detailed, and because it was too big. But Ben put so much work in this. Check it out. It is chock full of good information, and I believe it is on sale on Amazon right now. So you can check out Ben's book and my book on Amazon, The Carnivore Code and Boundless. What a pair. And if you guys want to come to Spokane and do some wilderness running around in loincloths with Ben and I, you are always welcome. The other thing that I want to tell you guys about this week are my sponsors. I so appreciate all of their support for this podcast. Right now, there is so much concern about how we are going to get well-raised foods, and Buy Ranch Direct is an amazing farm in Northern California doing grass-fed, grass-finished meat and organs. They are regenerative. This is my heart, my soul. This is what I am so passionate about, is supporting farms like this. You can check them out at buyranchdirect.com. You can use CarnivoreMD for 10% off your first order, and you can have amazing meat delivered straight to your door. You don't have to go to the grocery store. And if the grocery store is sold out of the things you want, you can get it from these guys, and they are doing it right. Check them out, buyranchdirect.com. They have a beautiful farm up there in California, and they sent me a bunch of the meat. It is amazing. They have organ meats. They have beef, bison. They have yak. How about a yak steak tonight for dinner? Wouldn't that be amazing? Buyranchdirect.com, CarnivoreMD for 10% off. These are the farms that are heading up the change. This is the answer. This is the incontrovertible argument regarding the sustainability of farming and animal agriculture. And what we know is that having animals on the land will regenerate the soil, which is the answer for the long-term health and sustainability, vitality of our planet. It sounds cliche, but it is so true. The other people that are amazing in this space are White Oak Pastures. You guys are all familiar with them if you've listened to my podcast before. WhiteOakPastures.com. You can use CarnivoreMD there for 10% off your first order as well. And we were going to do an event there, White Oak Chella. It was supposed to be in May. It's going to be postponed till the fall, you guys. I'm so sorry. But believe me, we will have this celebration of life and art and music and the proper way to raise animals in a regenerative fashion with rotational grazing at White Oak Pastures this fall, and I will see you guys all there. They have so many things at White Oak. They are doing their best to have as much stock as possible. One of the great things about the current time is that we can get meat from these amazing farms doing regenerative rotational grazing, which are carbon negative in the life cycle analyses. They are increasing the organic matter in the soil. White Oak is leading the charge here, sixth generation, 150 years in the family. Last 20 years, my man Will Harris has been farming it regeneratively, and the soil organic matter content has gone from 0.5 to 5%. The soil is so dark there. It looks like chocolate. And, you know, you guys know I'm not a huge fan of chocolate, but I appreciated chocolate growing up. The soil is dark. It is chocolate. Chocolate brown is dark chocolate brown. So check out White Oak Pastures. Check out their soil. Check out their meat. And support them and Buy Ranch Direct for some regenerative agriculture raised meats in these crazy times. Nourish your family, support the proper raising of these animals. The last sponsor of the podcast are my men and women of Ancestral Supplements, ancestralsupplements.com. As you know, they are putting back in what the modern world has left out. They are providing grass-fed, grass-finished organ supplements and conveniently encapsulated conveniently, one or the other, in a gelatin capsule, which makes them so convenient to consume. We know that eating nose to tail is so nutritious, is so vital for humans. Ben Greenfield and I got into a fascinating little conversation during this podcast talking about peptides that occur normally in the thymus. Thymusin alpha 1, TA1 is something you could get in a peptide from a peptide company, but you can also get it from eating thymus. Well, how many of us have access to thymus? Not many. But what's amazing is the guys and gals in Ancestral Supplements are helping us get these things in desiccated, so freeze-dried, low-temperature, dehydrated supplements in gelatin, and you can get thymus. As Ben says in this podcast, he's been taking lung. You can get brain. You can get eyeball. You can get all kinds of good stuff. But I think especially in these crazy times, to support the immune system, I would think about thymus and lung, as we talk about in this podcast. And Ancestral Supplements is a fantastic source for that because it is basically impossible to get lung otherwise. But these guys are magicians and magicianettes, I don't know, wizards and wizettes. I don't know. They're good people doing good things. Please support them. www.ancestralsupplements.com. You can get nose-to-tail, grass-finished organ supplements in a capsule. You can use Saladino MD at their Shopify site for 10% off. Let them know I sent you. Give them some love and let me know what you guys think of these guys and girls, or at least their product. They're all amazing, I assure you. And they are putting back in what the modern world has left out. And believe me, the modern world has left out so much. All right, you guys, on to the podcast. Without further ado, I love you all. Listen afterward for what is going on with me. Ben Greenfield, dude, it's so good to see you. I need a little bit of normalcy in my life right now amongst the coronavirus.
Seriously. Yeah, I'm getting very ronery out here in the middle of the forest. So, you know, these little video calls with folks like you help to keep my soul fed and know that everybody out there is still alive. So God bless social media for that.
Oh my God, it's some crazy times. For people that are listening to this podcast, they will know that it's recorded on March the 22nd, 2020. Basically every day right now, I'm not sure if we're going to see the next day or if Armageddon, the zombie apocalypse, or the coronavirus implosion of the world is going to come. So we were just chatting
Or just pure economic collapse from Trump sending us all checks.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about that too. And so I want to talk about your new book, which is Boundless. I've been waiting months and months to get on your schedule. It's been out for a couple months. It looks like it's crushing it. I had a chance to look at it and I'm so impressed. But just to open the show, we were just talking offline before the podcast and we thought, let's just start recording and let people hear what two geeky guys who want to be outside most of the time are thinking about right now. I mean, how are you handling this coronavirus situation? What are your thoughts? How are things in probably where I'm going to go? I'm going to show up at your front door this summer when things get real crazy.
Yeah. Well, I have an entire pantry full of sardines and probably about 25 white-tailed deer just out there waiting to be harvested. So there's, and I had a bunch of arrows made last week, a bunch of extra arrows made just in anticipation. I've already got a lot of ammunition stocked up, but figured I'd throw a few more sharp sticks into the mix just in case this thing goes on till, you know, whatever, this winter or beyond. I may have to start doing a little more harvesting than usual of the venison that's around the property. But, yeah, I mean, it's, we're just really seeing the blessings and, you know, the silver lining, lots of time now available to us as a family to bond, a lot more time for meditation, for nature immersion, a lot more time for kind of, not quite prepping activity, but more just learning how to do things like plan for the future as far as food preparation, as far as survival. You know, I've made sure everything's really, really well hooked up with our solar inverters. You know, we're already on well, and we, you know, we're relatively off grid out here, but just making sure all the boxes are checked as far as preparation is concerned. And, you know, we already do a ton of gardening. We do a ton of fermenting. I've actually been teaching myself how to sprout this week. So I've been doing a lot of sprouting. I've got all sorts of jars with big long tails growing out of seeds, and I'm setting those out in the sunlight, and they're turning green and, you know, concentrating the chlorophyll in those. And I've been making a lot of like coconut milk and goat milk ferments and yogurts and kefirs. And we're doing a lot of planting. My wife's growing a lot of grasses and a lot of shoots and doing a lot of planting out in the garden because we have about 8 raised vegetable beds out there. The boys are getting hot on me now to start to get all the fishing tackle and fishing equipment ready so we can start to go hit up the local lakes and harvest fish from there. And, you know, we're kind of treating it as a way to return to our roots ancestrally. And, you know, we don't go to the grocery store that often as it is, but, you know, it's kind of fun just planning life around, you know, what if we can't go to the grocery store and, you know, nothing's going to be available on Amazon. And between that and, man, just, and I actually wanted to touch on this with you and hear your thoughts about it, because, I'm doing what I would consider to be, with my family every single day, sometimes twice a day, one of the best things you can do, not only for your immunity, but also for your nervous system, and for your stress, and even to manage things like anxiety and fear. And we are doing some pretty intensive intermittent hypoxia and breath work sessions, particularly in the sauna, just dripping with sweat, you know, me and my boys and my wife. And then we're following that up with these long cold soaks out in the backyard. And so we're doing stuff like that twice a day. Well, you know, I've already stepped back on a lot of my hard training just because of the inflammatory response and the potential for a little bit more immune system susceptibility, you know, same as we would see in like an Ironman triathlete or a marathon or finishing up an event. You know, we know that 9 out of 10 of folks who do that, including myself in the past when I've done it, get sick within a few days after. And that's just because of the massive amount of inflammation and immune system downregulation that occurs in response to hefty training. So I've replaced a lot of my, you know, my hard training and my high intensity kettlebell stuff with long walks in the sunshine, like I'm doing right now, a lot of breath work. So we're literally doing like 20 to 40 minute breath work sessions. And then, you know, doing those in the sauna and doing a lot of cold as well. You know, I'm not an immunologist, I'm not an infectious disease specialist. And so, you know, and I think everybody's speaking to vitamin C and ozone and glycerinic acid and, you know, N-acetylcysteine and glutathione and, you know, all these things that, you know, may help in a situation like this. But man, breath work, heat, cold, and sunshine, you can't beat that stuff anyways, just for general health. But I think it's all the more important this time.
Yeah, and I've been trying to beat that drum on my social media as well, that I think sun has been underemphasized. I think stress relief has been underemphasized. And I think nutrition has been underemphasized. And I think that, you know, for the most part, what I've tried to focus on my social media platform is just saying, hey, what nutrients do we know we need for a healthy immune system? Vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin E, selenium, zinc, copper, those kind of things. And where do we get those from? You know, most of the time they're from animals, but I love the conversation around the nutrients in the immune system. And I like what you're adding to the conversation there about not overtaxing your immune system by overexercising. Hopefully there's nobody listening to this podcast now. Hopefully, you know, the listener is not thinking about training for a marathon right now. Probably not the best idea in these times.
Yeah. This isn't a time to use your cabin fever quarantine to go, you know, just do soul crushing workouts. I think a more kind of meditative parasympathetic approach to your self-care routine is more prudent right now. And remind me, I actually wanted to ask you about that vitamin A, vitamin D thing that you brought up. But one thing that I find really intriguing related to the breath work, and I talk about this a little bit in my book too, is, you know, when we look at breath work, there's a few really interesting things. And, you know, both Anders Olson and Patrick McCown has fantastic books out that delve into these matters a little bit more deeply. But this idea of nasal breathing, warming and humidifying the air, including on the exhalation, like normally we would see a cooling of the sinus passages if we exhale through our mouth, and a warming of them if we exhale through our nose. And we know that there's some viral susceptibility to maintenance of heat within the respiratory tract. And this idea of training yourself how to do deep, relaxed nasal breathing, I think, is important for that reason. We know that it causes a release of nitric oxide. And, you know, I don't know if you saw any of the studies on the antiviral activity of both nitric oxide as well as CO2, meaning that not only is it going to be helpful to boost nitric oxide through something like sunshine exposure or sauna or cold, but I think nasal breathing is also important for that. And then the style of breath work, meaning the same type of long exhales that we know cause the vagus nerve to amplify parasympathetic tone, that same thing could be carried forward into this idea of CO2 retention, like longer exhales than inhales. And this would mean, like, if you're out on your sunshine walk, you know, for 10 steps, breathe in, and for 20 steps, breathe out. If you're doing breath work, say in a sauna, you know, like what I'm doing with my boys is we're doing, you know, long 20-minute segments of in, two, out, two, three, four, in, two, out, two, three, four. And because we're doing a little bit of intermittent hypoxia as well, we're also doing a really long exhale and hold at the end of that. And then we do kind of what's called a power draw, where you draw all the air in and lock it up at the top of your head, and then just repeat that through multiple cycles, kind of similar to what you do with something like holotropic breath work. You get you can get some CO2 retention as well with those longer exhales. And then the other thing I really like, just as far as the breath work goes, is of course just the mindful component, you know, down regulation of anxiety and fear and the sympathetic response. And so, see, I think one thing people could do with this time is just use as a chance to teach yourself some really good breathwork tactics. And man, if you can combine it, you know, like, you know, this morning, for example, my quote workout unquote was a long walk with a 10 count inhale, 20 count exhale, followed by about an 8-minute cold soak. And, you know, those are the type of routines that I think are going to be really good for people to look into right now.
Yeah, I love that section in your book. You have a whole chapter about breathing, and you take people through multiple breathing techniques. You talk about the Buteyko breathing, which we can go into more detail about. That's something I've spoken about a little bit on the podcast previously. You talk about this box breathing, the 4 seconds for inhale, 4 seconds hold, 4 seconds exhale, 4 seconds hold, and you talk about some of these other techniques. Just for the listener, why don't you take us through a breathing exercise right now? Like, let's do it together so that people can walk away with some techniques.
Okay, sure. Yeah. I suppose if someone is listening while they are driving or operating heavy machinery or doing brain surgery, you may want to forego and put the podcast on hold and maybe wait until you're sitting cross-legged somewhere or laying down on your back. But we can do it. We can do a quick round of the type of stuff I've been doing with my boys. I'll walk you through about 90 seconds, and then we'll finish with that kind of power draw technique. But if people want to join in, basically you're going to do the breath in through your nose, and then the breath out can be through the nose or through pursed lips. And what you should ideally be doing is when you breathe in, you want that breath to be from deep in the belly. And at the same time, you want to kind of contract all your perineal muscles, you know, kind of like a Kegel where you'd stop the flow of urine if you were urinating. So when you breathe in, you're going to kind of squeeze. And then when you breathe out, you relax everything. And it's typically a longer exhale than an inhale. So it would look like this if people want to join in. In, two, out, two, three, four. In, two, out, two, three, four. Squeeze, two, relax, two, three, four. Squeeze, two, relax, two, three, four. In, two, out, two, three, four. In, two, out, two, three, four. I'm going to stop counting pretty soon and just let you focus on that breath. So, do about 45 more seconds. Out, two, three, four. In, two, out, two, three, four. Squeeze, two, relax, two, three, four. Good. Five more cycles. Out, two, three, four. In, two, out, two, three, four. In, two, out, two, three, four. Squeeze, two, relax, two, three, four. In, two, out, two, three, four. Full inhale and exhale everything out. Breathe everything out of the lungs. You can drop your chin if you need to. Push, 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 push. Push everything out. Push everything out. Push, 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 push. And hold that exhale for as long as you can. For as long as you can, hold the exhale. Hold it. Hold it. Hold it. Hold it. Now, eventually, you're going to have that urge to breathe. When you have that urge to breathe, you're going to suck all the air in. As soon as you have that urge, draw all the air in. And suck, 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 suck the air in. And at the same time, squeeze those perineal muscles, squeeze the sex organs, and try and drive all the energy up to the top of the head. And just hold all the energy all the way up at the top of the head. Hold it. Hold it. Hold it. When you're going to be ready to let your breath out, one of the things that's really great for vagal nerve tone, for lymph circulation, and almost for like this really cool parasympathetic effect on the body is when you breathe out, you're just going to do one long om. So you're going to, when you're ready to breathe out, let's go. Om.
Home.
Good, good. Now, in an ideal scenario, what we just did, the 90 seconds of the in, two, out, two, three, four, you would actually kind of buckle up for a meditative type of practice, and you do that for anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes. And if you do it for 10 to 20 minutes, that final exhale that you take, you like some people who don't even do breath retention practice, they'll hold it for like 2, 3, 4 minutes, like way longer than you'd expect to be able to hold because you breathed off a lot of CO2. And then when you take that breath in, same thing. Sometimes you'll retain it without a whole lot of effort for like 3 or 4 minutes. And it just absolutely takes you to a whole different place mentally. And if you do something like this, say in a sauna, dry sauna or an infrared sauna, and then finish up, you know, after you've got all that nitric oxide circulating through your body with about anywhere from a 2 to a 10 minute cold soak. It's just, that's an amazing daily practice to be doing during these times.
I love it, dude. Thanks for taking us through that. And I love that you highlighted the nitric oxide component of nasal breathing. I did a podcast previously with Malcolm Kendrick, and nitric oxide came up over and over in that podcast. We were talking about endothelial health, vascular health. We highlighted the fact that drugs which impair nitric oxide formation at the level of the endothelium are connected with atherosclerosis, and drugs that can improve nitric oxide formation might improve atherosclerosis or improve cardiovascular outcomes. people can listen to that podcast if they're curious. But that's an interesting segue to something that you talk about at the beginning of the book, which is the blood-brain barrier. And, you know, we were just doing all this breathing and we're doing this exhalation. We are affecting blood vessels in our brain with different levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide. But I loved what you said about the blood-brain barrier in your book and how the blood-brain barrier can become leaky. Talk to me about that a little bit. Walk us through that.
Yeah. Yeah. Particular blood-brain barrier permeability, I think, it is a big issue. It's difficult to test for. Apparently there are, you know, and I talk in the book about a couple kind of fringe tests that might indicate increased blood-brain barrier permeability. I think one is an MMP evaluation, but really if you are living a lifestyle of chronic stress, if you're low on sleep, we know that ethanol toxicity, so if you're drinking to excess, you know, that's going to induce blood-brain barrier permeability. Magnesium deficits, and even poor vagal nerve tone, you know, which can be improved using the type of practices that we were just talking about. All these things can increase blood-brain barrier permeability, and very similar to gut blood permeability, allow for particles or toxins to enter into neural tissue that should not normally otherwise be there. And so there are things you can do to improve the integrity of your blood-brain barrier. We know that magnesium can assist with that. We know that, the vagal nerve tone induced by things like cold soaks or even cold face dunks or exposure of the head to the cold can do that. We know that attention paid to exposure to non-native EMF may also have an impact on blood-brain permeability. There's a lot of things that can affect it, sleep probably being one of the more important, which is, of course, all the more important during this time that we're in right now. And breath work can assist with it as well due to that nitric oxide component. But I think that, you know, there's in the entire book, I kind of wrote around brain or mind, body, and then finally spiritual optimization. And yeah, two of the really important things I talk about in the brain section are A, neurotransmitter balance, you know, via everything from adequate amino acid and vitamin B12 intake to, you know, mitigation of sensory overload and overuse of stimulants. And then for the blood-brain barrier piece, just paying attention to sleep, ethanol toxicity, magnesium, nitric oxide, vagal nerve tone. I mean, these are all things that can affect cognitive function and neural health pretty dramatically.
I love it. And I'll highlight the thing that you said about the cold water on the face. This is part of the mammalian dive reflex, which is fascinating to me that humans, you know, we have this ancestry of somehow having a heart rate that drops when we dunk our face in the water. And so one of the things that we used to recommend to patients when I was in residency was if you are having lots of anxiety or you are having a panic attack or you are feeling very emotionally triggered, put your face in cold water. It's going to absolutely kind of short circuit a lot of your body's fight or flight mechanisms and can really increase the parasympathetic tone because that's what's happening in our body. You can just put your face in cold water. We should all probably have a bowl big enough for our face in our house, right? Like if you guys don't have a bowl,
You know what I recently got? I don't know if you've seen this Marazco Forge. It's like an ice bath. They send you out. It's like a done for you ice bath. They treat it with UV and ozone. And you can always, a lot of people will do this if they're using a chest freezer that you buy from the department store or whatever. You can use a little food grade hydrogen peroxide to clean it afterwards. But this one's automatically cleaned with UV and ozone. And then it'll maintain like 32 degrees at up around 110 degrees Fahrenheit. So I literally have like one of those on it maces out next. So I got to break through the ice to get in. And you know, that just sits right outside my office. So I can literally wander outside my office at any point during the day and hop in that thing. It's a pretty sexy setup for like a cold plunge. But yeah, I mean, it can be as simple as getting your head wet. And you know, there's a great journalist, a really good, in this case, pun intended, immersive journalist named James Nestor. He just wrote a wonderful book called Breathe. My kids are homeschooled, and so they do a book report every week. They get to go choose a book from my office and do a book report every week, and both of them are doing a book report on Breathe right now, which ties in really well with the breathwork routines I'm taking them through. But prior to that, I interviewed James on my podcast because he wrote a book about freediving. and, you know, how Olympic athletes are utilizing free diving courses to do things like get the splenic compression that leads to the amplified erythropoietin release. But then they're also doing it for that vagal nerve tone you get from the mammalian dive reflex response to free diving. And I actually went down after I read his book and interviewed him. I got so interested in free diving. I flew down to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and took what I would consider to be one of the better free diving courses out there. Probably that one or the one they have down in Kona are two of the best ones. But the one in Fort Lauderdale was called Immersion Free Diving with Ted Hardy. And it was about 5 days of classroom and pool instruction, and then 2 days out in the ocean. And I went from a 220 static breath hold up to a 445 static breath hold in the pool in his course. I went from being nervous as hell to go any lower than 15 feet because I just couldn't seem to equalize and maintain my my stress levels going any deeper than that. He got me down to 80 feet by the end of the week, free diving. And then the coolest part is, of course, as soon as you learn that skill, not only are you training your mammalian dive reflex, your vagal tone, your anxiety and fear response, your splenic contracture, the splenic compression that leads to the red blood cell release, but of course, once you've got free diving skills in your back pocket, then you can spearfish. And I think spearfishing is just, it's like, I get bored now with regular fishing. I just like can't fish off a boat or off the shore anymore without being bored out of my mind after having experienced the thrill of being underwater with your gun, choosing the fish that you want, going after it. You know, it's great exercise, get a little cold thermogenesis and breath work thrown in. But man, if anybody wants something really fun as like a life skill that I think is, for me, it's right up there with bow hunting. Learn how to free dive and then, you know, get yourself a sling or a spear gun and start to spear fish. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, being in San Diego now, it's something that I want to get into in the near future, both the free diving and the spear fishing. And again, all of this kind of breath work comes with the caveat, don't do this in the water by yourself. Don't do this while you're driving. Don't pass out doing this stuff. Be careful when you're doing this stuff. And
Yeah, especially for the longer breath work sessions, the way I do them is just laying flat on my back. So I only do that about once or twice a month where I'll do like a full hour long, really deep intermittent hypoxic session. And, you know, I just do that laying on my back. But I mean, when I took Ted Hardy's course, you know, he gave us a bunch of CO2 and O2 training tables, right, with certain time intervals between breath holds or certain time intervals between exhales. And I mean, you know, he told us stories about how he would just sit there because he's a free dive competitor watching a movie, you know, doing his apnea tables. And a couple of times he'd just like pass out, sit next to his girlfriend watching a movie. And so, yeah, you do need to be careful where you practice this stuff and always under supervision.
Yeah, I've experimented a little bit with the Wim Hof type style breathing, which is a little bit of what we were doing earlier, kind of that forced exhalation, that forced respiratory alkalosis. And I agree with you, yep. It can lead to some pretty profound states of meditation and probably some parasympathetic release. And I've definitely passed out doing it because I had some long breath holds. When we deplete all the carbon dioxide, you can blow off all of the carbon dioxide from your body. And
exactly. Yeah. And I should clarify, by the way, Paul, what we did was indeed blowing off CO2. So I don't want to create any confusion around what I was explaining earlier. So CO2 retention, simultaneous oxygen and CO2 retention based on the Bohr effect allows for better oxygen dissociation into tissue, right? And the way that you would achieve that would be to, as I was talking about earlier, simply take very relaxed and long exhales along with full inhales. So that's oxygen and carbon dioxide tolerance. And it's interesting because if you look at like the bowhead whale or the naked mole rat or some really long-lived mammalian species, they actually display pretty high natural CO2 tolerance. So it may also be a little bit of a longevity play too to teach yourself how to maintain oxygen and carbon dioxide at high levels simultaneously. But then once you get to the point where you're doing, instead of long and slow exhales, very forced exhales with limited inhales, which was the breath work that I just took us through, that, as you've just alluded to, is blowing off CO2, which can be very useful for a longer breath hold time and for intermittent hypoxic training. But at the same time, because CO2 is your body's signal to breathe, or one of the body's signals to breathe, when you breathe off CO2 like that and then say go underwater or do a dive or something like that, yes, you can hold your breath for a longer period of time, but you also vastly increase your risk of passing out or shallow water blackout, because by the time you realize you're supposed to breathe, it's too late.
And that's happened to me on dry land as well. It was a little scary. And like your instructor said, if you do it on the couch, your body kicks off and you just start to breathe. Your brain kicks off and you start to breathe. But if you're underwater, that's problematic. So people need to be very careful with that. So powerful, powerful stuff. One of the other things you talk about in the chapter on breathing in your book that I just want to unpack a little bit for people is the myth of adrenal fatigue. So I love this chapter in the book because it's so relevant to what we're all going through today. Just lots of stress, lots of uncertainty. We talked a little bit about the breathing. I would encourage people to check out the book and the instructions you give about the various breathing parts, but you also kind of break down this adrenal fatigue myth. I think a lot of people listening may have heard of adrenal fatigue. Let's just dig into this a little bit before we move on to some other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like fibromyalgia, often used as a catch-all term, in many cases inaccurately. And they're, you know, just like fibromyalgia, you know, it could be everything from you know, fascial adhesions to lack of minerals to even, you know, food issues such as uric acid and oxalates, et cetera. The same thing could be said for adrenal fatigue. I mean, sometimes it is, you know, mineral and vitamin C depletion. Sometimes it is actual overreaching or overtraining. And sometimes it is the wrong type of fat intake or low cholesterol intake or something that's leading to lack of the proper building blocks, you know, for the endocrine system, for things like DHEA and testosterone. But in other cases, it's just improperly diagnosed. You know, like a lot of people will get these blood-based cortisol tests and see something like, let's say, suppressed cortisol. And, you know, on a blood test, yeah, you might see that as a snapshot. But then if you do something, you know, like what I run on most of my clients is a dried urine test, because you get a snapshot of cortisol at multiple intervals throughout the day. But then you also can see upstream and downstream metabolites of, you know, everything from cortisol to testosterone to estrogens to melatonin. And so let's say that someone, they're showing really low cortisol and they've been told that they have adrenal fatigue, but then you run a Dutch panel and you actually see really, really high levels of cortisol metabolites, meaning that cortisol is just being metabolized very, very quickly, but it's not as though the adrenal glands aren't actually making cortisol or that the adrenal glands are exhausted or pooped out. They just might have, you know, high cortisol turnover. And, you know, in a case like that, sometimes that would be related to something like hyperthyroidism, for example. And the same could be said, you know, in the opposite. Some people think, oh, I have rampant high cortisol levels, and sometimes they just have low cortisol metabolites and low cortisol turnover due to, you know, poor metabolic or mitochondrial activity or hypothyroidism or something else is causing cortisol dysregulation. And so I think, you know, many, many people think they have adrenal fatigue or think they have something like hypercortisolism, when in fact the testing method, in my opinion, is wrong. You know, a blood-based cortisol evaluation versus something like a dried urine test, or, you know, there's a lot of other issues at play beyond just, you know, I'm so stressed and my adrenals have been pooped out. Like, you know, again, minerals, vitamin C, you know, food intolerance issues, et cetera. So I think that rather than just painting with the broad brush of adrenal fatigue, just like painting with the broad brush of fibromyalgia, there's a lot more deeper and precise digging that needs to be done in a situation like that.
Yeah, I think we totally agree on that. And for me, what's so frustrating is that oftentimes these basic tests will be done, whether it's a salivary cortisol curve for 24 hours or just an AM cortisol or just a clinical diagnosis of adrenal fatigue. And too rarely does anyone get recommended to look into the causes of these things, right? So it's the question of what is causing these imbalances in hormones. I get clients and patients all the time telling me, do you think my hormones are messed up? Could this be a hormonal issue? And my first thought is always, it's almost never primarily a hormonal issue. I think the hormones give us indicators of They're a litmus test for other systems in our body, whether it's nutrient adequacy, whether it's overall sleep quality, whether it's inflammation, whether it's insulin resistance. But very rarely are hormones messed up in and of themselves. Hormones, I think, are very rarely the primary drivers. Occasionally they are if there's hypothyroidism, but then the question is, why is someone hypothyroid? So often we have to look beyond what is causing into the realm of what is causing the hormones to be abnormal. And I think that's the key. And that's what you were alluding to, that it, that with, when someone has inadequate or apparently abnormal cortisol levels, there's often a lot more below the surface that we need to dig into and that we need to look at to tell what's actually going on there and to unpack it for people. So much more there. And it's very rarely, it's not a catch-all phrase. It doesn't work like that. We don't just get adrenal fatigue. Like you said, there's minerals or sleep or inflammation or these other issues. And looking at the metabolites in something like a Dutch test can be super helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. By the way, my dogs just decided to run out and join me. That's Dasher and Comet up there.
I've met them.
I think you met Comet when you came up. I don't think we had Dasher yet, but yeah, they're out here with me now.
Nice.
And by the way, lest I forget, because I briefly alluded to it when you brought it up, related to the whole coronavirus issue and the fat-soluble vitamins, particularly vitamin A and vitamin D, I wanted to actually hear your take on this. Not that I want to flip the tables and interview you on your podcast, but you know, I've come across some conflicting recommendations on like higher dose vitamin A and vitamin D intake potentially increasing susceptibility, I believe based on their interaction with some of these ACE receptors that coronavirus is targeting in lung tissue. Have you come across anything like that? Like the potential for increased susceptibility with like mega doses of vitamin A and vitamin D?
Well, again, I think there is a possibility with mega dosing, but we have to be very careful what we're talking about with mega dosing versus actual physiologic dosing from the sun or from food. So I think that's very nuanced. I know Chris Masterjohn was mentioning that, and I thought that most of his stuff looked like a lot of conjecture to me. He was recommending against vitamin A and vitamin D supplementation. And to be very clear with this, I recommend against vitamin A and vitamin D supplementation too, because I think that we should be getting it from the sun and from food. And I have a pretty strong suspicion that the way that our body uses nutrients is different when we're getting it from the sun and from food versus a supplement. So there's so many rabbit holes to go down, but I've talked about this a lot.
Unless it's more of like a whole foods based stuff. Like I personally use, I think you turned me onto these guys, the Ancestral Supplements.
Yeah.
And you know, this might be, you know, so, you know, especially when I travel, I'm utilizing those for a lot of those vitamins. This might actually be, you know, purely inaccurate speculation and just based on this whole idea of the doctrine of signatures in nature. But for the past 3 weeks since the coronavirus thing hit, the one I've been using most often is the beef lung. And so I think I'm taking like 4 or 5 of those capsules a day. I have no clue if they're actually going to provide any type of protective effect for lung tissue, but I've been popping those nonetheless.
I think that thymus is also a reasonable thing as well. And we need more studies. We need more studies to look at this. Thymus is an immune gland. This is actually an interesting segue into a little bit of what could be a conjectured conversation about some of these peptides, because there's a peptide now that people are using, TA1, right? So thymus and alpha 1.
Yeah, thymus and alpha. Yeah, there's a lot of doctors are prescribing that right now. Thymus and alpha, and then a lot are also recommending LL37 for its antiviral activity.
Uh-huh. And where is LL37 from? What is LL37? I'm not as familiar with that one.
Well, LL37 apparently what it does is it prevents the binding of the virus to receptors. And it's also used a lot of times for like Giardia and food poisoning and things like that. Like I actually have always had a bottle handy in my fridge, but generally it's used for not for immune system enhancement as much as like acute GI issues or bacterial or viral infections. And then the thymosin is more for just general immune system support, the thymosin alpha. And those are the two that I've seen, you know, doctors who are using peptides recommending the most. And then of course, if an infection occurs and there's this inflammatory firestorm, the BPC-157 for for controlling that, just injected systemically, you know, like a subcutaneous injection of BPC.
Yeah. And from my perspective, I'm fascinated by the peptides in various organs. The thymus and alpha one is so fascinating to me, thinking, because I eat thymus every day, right? I eat a real thymus. I eat part of a real thymus every day. And do these peptides survive digestion? You know, could we be getting some oral? Because BPC 157, as you're saying, now has an oral formulation and a sub-Q formulation. So could oral, is it possible that oral thymus and alpha-1 could be beneficial for our immune system? This gets into just one of the most fascinating rabbit holes for me in terms of the nose-to-tail equation. How many of these organs that we are eating could have things in them, peptides, signaling molecules, growth factors that are beneficial for our body that we don't even know about? And this concept you mentioned, you know, the concept of signatures and that life like supports like is intriguing, and it's intuitive. And I really want to see if we can generate some hard scientific data to further corroborate that. But I think it's totally reasonable right now to try a lung, desiccated lung, thymus, probably liver, kidney. I mean, all of these things could have very beneficial things for our bodies in them. And that's just, that's a whole untapped thing. You know, that's like the whole new wave of peptides, in my opinion. Like, what if there's a peptide in liver that we don't even know about, right? Yeah. Or one in kidney, or, I mean, you know, one in testicle, which, you know, all the guys would love to hear.
I find a lot of the Russian research on peptides, like the Kavinsin protocol, and I talk about this in the anti-aging chapter of the book. You know, and they did, I think it's for 10 days, twice a year, injection of the peptide Epitalin, and found reduced all-cause risk of mortality and a significant effect on mitochondrial proliferation. And I mean, it's not that expensive, and it's also not that much of a pain in the ass to do a 10-day injection twice a year. And that's one also that I know a lot of docs are using now.
Epitalin. Where does it come from? Are you familiar with any other peptides that come from organs? The origin of these peptides is interesting for me.
No. I mean, well, right now, the way that they're made, if you're purchasing them, they come in a little vial that you typically mix with like a bacteriostatic water and inject subcutaneously. Most of them, at least the good ones, are made using an amino acid sequencer. You know, that's like, I get most of mine from TaylorMade Compounding in Kentucky. And, you know, never, ever buy online, like from some pharmacy website online, just because in most cases from what I understand, the way that they do it is they're actually using like an E. coli medium and like, you know, harvesting essentially what these E. coli are producing and getting kind of an inaccurate peptide sequence, or, you know, not a whole lot of consistency in terms of the quality of the peptide. But as far as the peptides that you purchase right now for injection, the good ones are made using amino acid sequencers. I tell people to just go to the website for the International Peptide Society, where there's usually I think it's peptidesociety.org, and all those doctors have been trained, and most of them are prescribing peptides that are made using these amino acid sequencers.
Yeah. I guess what my question was, do you know which peptides might have come from organs, like the thymus and alpha one, or where are they coming from? I guess we're creating synthetic versions
like
of molecules.
Like if you wanted to replicate those in nature.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like obviously thymus and probably would be thymus, but you know, something like epithelin, I'm actually not sure, you know, which gland or organ that would be derived from.
Or if it's just a synthetic molecule that kind of, like, I know BPC 157 is kind of one of these, it's like a growth hormone analog, you know, some of them are fragments of molecules that occur
like
in our body.
BPC, for example, that's naturally made in the gastric juices. So, you know, that would be an example of something that we'd find in the gastrointestinal tract.
Oh, interesting. Because, you know, we're starting to see, I know Ancestral Supplements and is doing an intestine. They have an intestine, desiccated intestine supplement. And that could have some endogenous BPC 157 in it. Then interesting.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if we could actually test for peptide content in some of these. I'm not quite sure if you could reverse engineer the whole amino acid sequencing and find out. That's beyond my pay grade, but it's possible. It'd be interesting to know.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated to think about which peptides we might not even know about, which ones we know about that are already in the human body, you know, and we could get by eating nose to tail, and which ones we might not even know about, like, you know, the magical peptide in the spleen, because I don't know, how many of the organs have you eaten? I guess we've had testicle together. You've had liver. Have you ever had spleen?
I haven't had spleen. Oh, have you?
Yeah, I love it. I eat it like almost every day now. And pancreas, have you had pancreas?
I have had pancreas. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. And you've had thymus?
Haven't had thymus. Nope.
Oh, we got to get you some of that too. Nope. We'll get white oak. We'll get white oak to send you some thymus right now.
I took my kids on a hunting course a few months ago, and we harvested the the fat around the stomach of a sheep. It's I'm blanking on it now. Is it the tripe?
Like the perinephric fat?
No, not the suet.
Oh, the mesentery.
We got that as well. Yeah, but it basically surrounds the entire stomach. It's almost like a bag of fat. And so if you do your field dressing very carefully, you can have like this nice long layer of fat. And I'm sure you're familiar with the Scottish Russian Peeper haggis. And so what I did was I harvested the lungs, the kidney, the heart, and the suet, and basically like finely cubed all of that, and then wrapped it in this entire bag of fat from around the sheep's stomach. And I essentially baked it for about an hour and a half or so at around 350 degrees. And the fat kind of caramelized over the top of all of these organ meats that I had cubed inside this bag of fat. Dude, you would have had a food orgasm trying this stuff. I mean, it was just pure dripping, rich goodness. I think I posted on my Instagram channel, and most of the comments were, "That looks like, you know, just god awful shit." But it was absolutely amazing. It was like an organ casserole.
Which is so amazing. It's so sad to me that it's hard for all of us to really get on board with organs because we've never eaten them in the past. And so many people will just say like, "That looks gross." And you think, wow, more for me, more for you, more for Ben and I at this point, because those foods are amazing and those foods are magical. And if there's magic in any food, it's organ meats. I've found recently, and I don't know, this is just maybe where I'm moving with my own kind of nose to tail carnivore diet. I've found that I'm more excited about eating organs than I am about eating meat. I still love eating meat from good farms like Belcampo and White Oak Pastures, but what I really get excited about is eating the organs. And those are like, it's like the dessert. It's like the part of the meal that I'm most excited about is the organs.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Hey, speaking of eating meat, I have a question. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I thought about this last night while I was reading. I wanted to get your take on it because it's kind of part of the whole, you know, the whole carnivore diet approach. And so I've been studying up a lot on the Spokane Indian tribes because I'm just very, very interested in the history of the land that's directly around my home in Spokane, Washington. And I know that there was a trading post literally like a mile from my house, as well as a pretty big battle on the Paone Prairie that my living room window looks over. And I decided a couple of months ago, I just want to know more about the history of this tribe and also what even occurred literally like minutes away from where I'm living every single day, just because I'm intensely curious about the history of the region. And so I was reading up on the Spokane Indian tribe, and I got into a chapter last night where they were talking about how they, during the salmon runs, as the salmon are swimming upstream and up into the Spokane Falls, they would have a bunch of like wicker-esque baskets underneath the falls. And these salmon would be so exhausted as they're swimming upstream that many of them would fall out of the falls as they're trying to jump through the falls and wind up back in these baskets. And they would harvest literally like thousands of pounds of salmon just because they were so dense in the Spokane River on a daily basis throughout this fishing season. And then at the same time, they also, you know, like a lot of these tribes had such rich access to these large animals, you know, like deer and elk and moose, for example. They were literally using, you know, amongst other hunting methods, the method where you're just basically like driving these animals off of cliffs and harvesting all the meat at the bottom. They had tons of meat. They had tons of fish. But then it went into how, while the men were out doing that, the women were harvesting carrots, parsnips, elderberry, this starch that grows here. It's called camas root, I think is the name of the starch, sarsaparilla, berries. And this was not because the animals and the fish were deficient or not available, because they obviously were, with the thousands of pounds of salmon and all these animals that are driving off cliffs. Yet while the men were out doing this, the women were still harvesting all these plants to almost dress up and have along with the animals. And you know, I thought of you and I'm like, well, what would Paul's take on this would be, because they obviously were using it for survival food. They were using it as kind of like an accessory to all the animal food that they were consuming. Have you thought about that or come across that in as examples of, from other cultures?
Yeah, that happens occasionally in other cultures. What's interesting for me is a couple of things that come up in that discussion. Do you know anything about the ratios of those foods? Like how much of their food was meat versus how much were these other foods? Were they using it kind of for flavor and kind of a dressing, or were they eating significant amounts of calories from the other foods?
Yeah, I don't know. Apparently they could make a ton of these, like little, almost like pancakes from the camas root. And I know they were getting a lot of berries, and you know, the carrots and the parsnips piece, you know, because during that same hunting course I took with the kids, where, you know, I harvested all those organs from the sheep. You know, we did a lot of plant foraging too, and we were harvesting a lot of starch mediums, you know, digging up a lot of roots out in the field. And we got, like, you know, we worked for like 2 hours at one point, like shaving cattail and harvesting these little, they're almost like hazelnuts, and making pancakes out of them. And, you know, hunched around the campfire for like 2 hours, we each wound up, I was laughing because we worked so hard, and we each wound up with like a silver dollar sized pancake after about 3 hours of work. And so maybe they had some method that I wasn't taught or we weren't aware of, but you know, where my mind goes is how the hell could it not have been used as some kind of a condiment or as a way to like dress up and spice and flavor the food? I'm not sure. Maybe they had some, you know, factory line method that allowed for far more efficiency. But yeah, it was kind of a disconnect for me reading the book and thinking, well, gosh, when I've tried to do that, you know, even with the help of a plant foraging expert, it seems like it'd be a lot easier to just go kill an animal, as you and I have talked about in the past. But you know, at the same time, there must have been a reason they kept returning to it year after year and harvesting all these plants.
Yeah, the other piece of that equation that I think is quite fascinating, I'll add to the discussion, which is that humans can't get more than 35 to 40% of their calories from protein. And so many of these animals are not big enough to have enough fat to sustain us. So we have to have either fat or carbohydrates in addition to protein in our diet. So a moose is probably almost big enough, but an animal has to be at least 15% body fat to make it sustainable to eat nose to tail exclusively. So one of the hypotheses here is that as we move from hunting megafauna to hunting smaller and smaller animals, I mean, you know this, having hunted deer. When I went to West Texas and hunted deer, they're probably like 5% body fat. You know, squirrels are like 3 to 4% body fat. There's not enough fat on a deer to live on without getting rabbit starvation, quote unquote. So cultures, peoples, American Indians, Native Americans, indigenous peoples throughout the world who are forced to hunt smaller animals that are less than 15% body fat must get carbohydrates by default. And, you know, I'm not sure what sort of implications this has for ancestral ideas and the actual viability of a carnivore diet evolutionarily, but I do think that the megafauna declined. And if we could have hunted a woolly mammoth, which has, you know, 20% body fat, that's a lot more fat that we can eat nose to tail because there's enough fat on there. But like these Hadza.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it would also be interesting to see how much, because those salmon, you know, especially with that cold river, because that river gets super cold, they're incredibly fatty fish. And I'd be curious to see if their consumption of some of those plant-based compounds change during fishing season when there's just, you know, those fish are just incredible sources of fat.
Yeah, but you got to have that magic fat amount in your diet. And if you can't get that amount of fat, then you have to get carbohydrates. And so I think it's reasonable to gather things like roots and berries. And in my book, I kind of talk about this, and I'm going to expand on it in the cookbook that I'm writing. kind of this plant toxicity spectrum. I think of the roots and the tubers and the berries as certainly less toxic plants than the things like the many of the seeds and many of the leaves. So we've kind of talked about that in the past, but it's an interesting idea. I think most of it is probably driven by those macronutrient requirements though. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's very similar to what I did. You know, when you came up to my house and I kind of first began to delve into the carnivore diet, you know, based on what I learned from you, was for me, it kind of turned into more of a Native American diet where I was pretty much doing, you know, fish, meat, organ meats, bone broth, berries, nuts, and seeds. And, tubers, underground storage organs, you know, pumpkins and summer squash, winter squash, stuff like that.
And I think that's a totally way to eat. And that's pretty close to what I might consider to be carnivore-ish or, you know, the kind of stuff I talk about in my book. And when I write the cookbook, that's how I want to write the cookbook. So I'm going to write a carnivore cookbook and it's not going to be just all meat. It's going to include those kind of like less toxic plant foods from an ancestral perspective. So people listening to this can get excited about the carnivore code cookbook. It's going to have all that kind of stuff in it. So cool. I know
I'll
you're, maybe we'll get some of Ben's recipes in the carnivore code cookbook. So I know your walk is probably coming to a close, but I wanted to talk about one or two more things that I love in your book. One of the coolest things that I saw you highlight in your book was this question, why some people don't lose fat. And I know this is a fascinating case study on an individual basis with some of my clients and people that I talk to on Instagram. A lot of people, when they do any sort of intentional diet change, lifestyle change, whether it's paleolithic or low carb or carnivore or carnivore-ish or the carnivore code, carnivore-ish diet, they lose weight pretty easily. But every once in a while, people say to me, I can't lose weight. And I love that you pointed out some of the reasons for this in your book, and it's something you've thought about a lot. So walk us through some of that stuff from your perspective. If somebody's having trouble losing weight despite intentional dietary changes, what do you think could be going on?
Yeah, I list about 20 reasons in the book, but of course, one of the biggies, the biggest elephant in the room, in my opinion, is just this concept of NEAT, you know, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, and the idea that, you know, the majority of calories we're burning during the day are a result of the low-level physical activity, you know, such as I'm doing right now, that we engage in apart from any type of formal exercise session, which technically, you know, one time would have been the realm of athletes and warriors and gladiators and people who either, you know, died or competed for a living and wasn't really like a weight loss strategy. So there are many, many people who are, you know, doing whatever, an F45 or a CrossFit session or a personal training session or, you know, whatever as a weight loss strategy, and then simply not moving enough the rest of the day. I mean, I have a minimum step count every day, and, you know, all of my clients have this as well, of 15,000 steps. So you're moving throughout the day. You know, and if you finish dinner and, you know, you look at your activity monitor and you're at whatever, 14,000 steps, that means you're taking a, you know, 10, 15 minute postprandial walk and, you know, calling your family or listening to a podcast or whatever. So the idea of non-exercise activity thermogenesis, I think a lot of people just don't realize how little they actually move apart from their formal exercise session. And, you know, that's a big one. Another big one that's kind of relevant to something we talked about earlier during our discussion today is the idea of temperature fluctuations, right? So like our home, you know, typically when I'm having breakfast in the morning, I've got goosebumps, right? It's like 61 degrees in our house. We rarely use the heater. We don't use the AC much. So in the summer you're sweating and in the winter you're shivering. And when you work that in, along with things like the frequent sauna practice, cold thermogenesis, cold soaks, cold water face dunks, cold showers, I think that temperature fluctuations and going outside your comfort zone from an environmental standpoint is another big one when it comes to either accelerating or decelerating weight loss. And then there's also probably the third biggest one I would touch on right now would be this idea of leptin insensitivity or leptin dysregulation brought on by cycling, particularly of body fat levels. This idea of going through the holidays and gaining, you know, 5% body fat for years and years of your life, and then, you know, maybe losing some of it in January and then kind of falling off the bandwagon February or March, and then realizing swimsuit season and summer is coming up, so you're going to lose weight again. I mean, that's a fast track to leptin insensitivity and leptin dysregulation, which affects appetite, as well as regulations that down-regulates mobilization of fatty acids from adipose tissue. And so maintaining stable weight, and I shouldn't even say stable weight, I should say stable body fat percentage as much as you can throughout the year, I think that's actually a pretty good strategy versus a lot of intensive, you know, weight cycling, weight gain, weight loss. And, you know, again, I think consistency, as dumb as it sounds, consistency in body fat levels is a real key also. So, you know, those are three things, you know, that I think are a few of the big ones of the many I list in the book would be non-exercise activity thermogenesis and just paying attention to low-level physical activity during the day, no matter how much you actually exercise. And then heat and cold fluctuation and being comfortable with being uncomfortable from a temperature standpoint. And then just paying attention to how much you're cycling as far as body fat percentage levels and maintaining more consistency with your weight particularly.
I like that last one, especially the leptin insensitivity. A lot of times I see that in people who have been more obese. They'll lose a certain amount of weight and they kind of plateau, and we think, is this a leptin threshold? Is there underlying leptin insensitivity here? Any thoughts about how to reset that? I've heard some people say extended fasting might be able to reset leptin sensitivity levels, but it seems to be...
No, it's the opposite. It's the opposite, actually. Regularly timed circadian rhythm activities, these so-called Zeitgebers, seem to be one of the best things for restoring leptin sensitivity. You know, Jack Cruz, and, you know, he's a controversial guy, and, you know, the accuracy of some of the information he puts out goes back and forth. He's a big advocate of cold and cold thermogenesis, and I haven't seen a lot of data on that particularly for leptin sensitivity. But as far as these Zeitgebers, in particular, a protein-rich breakfast, lots of sunlight exposure early in the day, some type of physical activity or movement performed at regularly timed intervals, especially early in the day, throughout the day, and then absence of a lot of blue light and intensive light at night, along with attention paid to sleep. Those seem to be some of the biggest. And when you look at circadian rhythmicity, you know, I am an intermittent faster, you know, 12 to 16 hours every day. And a lot of times I'm not eating an enormously protein-rich breakfast. But when I travel, when I'm jet-lagged, when I'm outside of my time zone, I actually make it a point to eat a protein-rich breakfast in whatever area of the world I happen to be in when it's breakfast time, because it's one of the best ways to maintain circadian rhythm. And it turns out that has an impact on leptin sensitivity as well. So I would say excessive intermittent fasting and or a protein-deficient breakfast would actually maintain a state of leptin insensitivity. So I would do a lot of intensive fasting if you're trying to restore leptin sensitivity.
Interesting. And people can, you know, the listener can check leptin levels. Fasting leptin level will give you a sense of your leptin sensitivity at baseline, give or take. You can check these things, kind of like fasting insulin. You can check a fasting leptin. But that's interesting. I'm certainly a fan of a protein-rich breakfast. You'll get no arguments from me about a protein-rich breakfast. But it is interesting that you are noting that circadian rhythmicity could be a key driver of this leptin insensitivity. And for many people who are having trouble losing weight, that could be an issue. Really look hard at how much protein you're getting for breakfast, at how strictly you are keeping your circadian rhythms, and work on those things. Because I do think that this leptin insensitivity, this leptin resistance, could be one of the things that is impairing people from losing weight. Another one you mentioned in the book that I've talked about previously on other podcasts and we'll talk about more in the future is underlying inflammation, especially, I think, GI dysbiosis. And I think that if there is inflammation in the body, that can be a real problem. That can cause some major problems with overall weight loss. Man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, both of Kate Shanahan's books, Deep Nutrition, and also she has a new one. I think it's called The Fat Fix, you know, and pretty much the entire, like, if you didn't want to get the books and wanted to fast track to the information, it's pretty much down-regulate inflammation through ruthless elimination of vegetable oil. And that's going to assist tremendously with fat loss in any scenario.
Yeah, and I think that's the key. And this is a great segue to one last thing, and then we'll wrap it up, which is this fatty acid ratios in the body. I've been thinking so much more about this. I think this is so fascinating. There's a part in your book where you talk about the hangover cure, and I'll let people read the book to see the whole hangover cure. But one of the things that you mention in there is that in people who have more omega-6 in their fatty acid sort of composition, alcohol is going to cause more oxidative damage in the liver and other places in the human body, which is fascinating. And I think this is true probably throughout the human body, that the sense that I got from your book, which was totally in line with what I believe, is that the majority of our fats should be monounsaturated and saturated. And I don't want to put words in your mouth. If you disagree, let me know. But I think that the majority of our fats should be monounsaturated and saturated fats, and a very small percentage of our fats should be polyunsaturated. And of that polyunsaturated fat, you know, some should be omega-3 and a very small percentage should be omega-6. And that if we increase the polyunsaturated fats too much, that we become more susceptible to oxidation. And so as Kate Shanahan is probably saying in those books, these vegetable oils, these corn, safflower, soy, you know, peanut, they are in everything. And if we eat too many of those oils that are especially high in linoleic acid and omega-6, and we enrich all the cells of our body, all the tissues of our body in these highly oxidizable oils, we're just prone to inflammation and oxidation, and those are going to really cause inflammation, and that too could trigger leptin resistance.
And cell membrane integrity. I mean, that's really the big one for me. I tell people this. I'm like, dude, if you were to offer me like a stick of cotton candy or a basket of let's say French fries, or even I don't know a you know grain fed meat cooked in canola oil, I'll eat the cotton candy 10 times out of 10 because blood glucose, I can go out and do a bunch of push-ups and, you know, go run for a little while, hit the gym, stay physically active, and that's going to have a pretty transient time in the bloodstream, and it's not going to do things like, you know, comprise my cell membranes for the next few weeks. Whereas, you know, vegetable oil, you know, that really truly is a situation where you are what you eat. And so, you know, I'd much, much rather have a meal comprised of, you know, not that one should be forced to choose between the lesser of two evils, but I'd choose a meal high in glucose, high in carbohydrates, high in sugar, high in fructose, far before I'd eat vegetable oils or you know, especially rancid or oxidized or pressurized seed oils.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And that's like the worst game of would you rather, would you rather eat processed sugar or processed vegetable oils? And both Ben and I answer, we would rather eat processed sugar, but I would rather just fast and not eat anything because that's a horrible thing in general. But I agree with you. And I love that Kate is going to highlight this in her next book. And I think it's something that both of us also point out in our books, that vegetable oils are just invariably horrible and should not be consumed under any circumstances. And we should be vigilant to know where they are. And I think that overconsumption of them and overconsumption of polyunsaturated fatty acids in general is going to be a major problem for humans in general. So,
yeah, I almost had a completely, aside from the fats within the meat itself, had an almost completely oil-free meal last night, meaning that I actually just posted to Instagram. I use your technique. I think I first did this with you at Drew Canoli's. We just basically took the ribeyes, dropped it in boiling water for about 3 or 4 minutes just to make sure any bacteria on the outside was killed, and then gave him a quick cold water dip.
I love it. I saw
and,
that.
I really dig that approach because then you just thin slice it and eat it like carpaccio, and it's amazing. You know, and all you need is a little salt with that method. But as I'm prone to do, I could not resist taking my jar of Mark Sissel's Primal Kitchen mayonnaise and slathering that on top of my steak. So I almost made it oil free, and then that mayonnaise was calling my name, and that actually that really made the meal over the top from a flavor standpoint, I have to admit.
But you know what's interesting for me is I think this is the popularity of avocado oil, probably for good reason. I'm a fan of tallow and animal fat primarily, but avocado oil is more monounsaturated fat. And you talk about this in your book as well, that olive oil, avocado oil, these are more omega-9. They're more monounsaturated fat. In the fatty acid molecule, there's one carbon, monounsaturated, where there's a double bond. There's one space between two carbons where there's a double bond, and that's a monounsaturated fat. And I think those are better than polyunsaturated fats for the most part. We need a little bit of of polyunsaturated fat, but we don't need as much as we've been told. And especially, I don't think we need very much linoleic acid at all. We need a small amount, but I think it will come in all of the foods we're eating normally. So those monounsaturated fats, good thing.
This might be the last thing I can throw in here before I'm starting to run out of time. This might open up a whole new can of worms, but like I mentioned, I've been sprouting, I've been like sprouting, alfalfa seeds and red clover seeds and broccoli seeds just to take cheap stuff we have laying around the house anyways. And in the case that there's a zombie apocalypse, be able to unlock some of these nutrients from foods and at least deactivate, some of the plant defense mechanisms via this whole concept of sprouting. But my next move is I'm going to start eating my avocados nose to tail, meaning that I discovered that you can actually sprout avocado seeds. It's a very long sprouting process. It takes about 3 weeks, but I'm going to try my hand at actually sprouting the avocado seed itself as a way to unlock some of the nutrients in that. So we'll see how it turns out, but I might actually write a book that's just called Avocados Nose to Tail.
Who knew that you could eat avocados nose to tail? What a great thing to end the podcast on. Ben, what is the most radical thing you have done recently? You more than anyone will have a good answer to this.
Oh, geez. I mean, especially with this whole coronavirus thing, I've done a lot of radical things recently. Started doing daily rectal insufflation of ozone. Okay. That was an interesting one. I'm nebulizing glutathione and acetylcysteine and colloidal silver every day. I would say probably, well, as controversial as this might sound and as much as I'd hate to send people down the slippery slope of abuse or dependence upon plant medicine, my wife and I now do quarterly plant medicine ceremonies together with each other as almost like couples therapy. And that's probably been one of the most transformative things that we have ever done for our relationship, is basically journeying together, sitting, facing each other in bed for, 6 to 8 hours at a time, and then integrating afterwards, taking those conversations and recording them and transcribing them. And so I would say about the most radical thing I've done that's been absolutely transformative for my relationship is some very deep, focused, proper set and setting with really good integration afterwards, plant medicine ceremonies with my wife, meaning we are actually journeying together, looking deep into each other's eyes and talking to each other the whole time. And it's just been absolutely amazing.
Is that with psilocybin?
I have a practitioner who uses about 40 different Amazonian plant medicines. Okay. And he's not even at liberty to tell us what he uses legally, but, he's an expert. Like, he specializes in couples therapy. And, I'm very wary of the use of any type of plant medicine aside from microdosing with psilocybin, for example, or something like that without, really, really good oversight, really good integration and proper attention paid to dosage, et cetera. I think a lot of people F themselves up with everything from DMT to ayahuasca to, some of these purging plant medicines. Like, I think that it actually can be a fast. I even just interviewed Max Lugavere recently on, for example, MDMA neurotoxicity. And I think the cons outweigh the pros of plant medicine in most circumstances, but under responsible use or via microdosing, or with the right shaman or integrator, I think that it actually can be pretty useful. And you just need to proceed with caution. Like, that's why I was a little bit, it came to mind, I was a little bit remiss to mention it just because, or a little bit cautious to mention it just because I think a lot of people abuse plant medicines. I think it's become one of those things where people are doing drugs now, and because it's considered honorable or acceptable, they basically have an excuse now. They have an out when really folks are just kind of getting high to have fun. And I think that that we do need to be careful with plant medicine. But it's been absolutely, as you say, radical for me and my wife to do a really, really, a closely supervised, responsible plant medicine ceremony on a quarterly basis.
That's very cool. Thanks so much for sharing that with me. I agree with you. I think they're very powerful medicines and should be used very cautiously and under the right settings. And we'll have to do a whole another podcast about plant medicines. Where can people find your stuff in your book, Ben?
Even though I do in the book, in chapter 5, I have a whole section on nootropics, smart drugs, and psychedelics and how to use them. So you can find a little bit of instruction there. It's at boundlessbook.com. or anywhere where you find books. It's got an Audible version, got a Kindle version, about a 650-page. I think you said at the beginning of the podcast that the book is crushing it. It literally is crushing some people because it's so heavy. but yeah, you can get anywhere fine books are sold. So yeah.
Well, it's a ton of work and you did a great job with it. I really enjoyed looking through it and exploring it and talking a little bit about it. We only scratched the surface, you guys. Check out Ben's book. Ben, it is a pleasure hanging out with you, my friend, and I hope to do so in person very soon. You know, I think that the upside of all this is the chances are increased that you and I are going to be running around in loincloths together soon. And that's a pleasant thought for me.
Hey, you know what? If shit hits the fan down there in San Diego and you don't get onto the spearfishing scene, come on up here and we can pick off some whitetails and sit around the fire pit.
That sounds good, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Later, Paul.
All right, radical people. As I said in the beginning, I hope you are all doing fantastically amid these crazy, 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 did I mention crazy times? Coronavirus, who knows what's going on here? Like I said, I did a podcast last week on Tuesday. I did a 17-minute video on chloroquine and coronavirus on my YouTube channel if you want to check that out. The Fundamental Health Insider, you can sign up for that at carnivoremd.com. It is out about every week and it has all kinds of good stuff. And I had all of the links to all of the snippets of my coronavirus thoughts this week. Here are my thoughts about coronavirus on Monday, March the 23rd, which is when I'm recording this. And the podcast will be out later today or tomorrow, Tuesday, March the 24th. The rate of transmission appears to be slowing, which is good, but there are still a large number of cases, and we are probably a few weeks out from knowing how many people are actually infected. I know that all of us will have people in our lives who are probably negatively affected by this virus, and I want to be sensitive to that. I also believe that probably some of the biggest ramifications of the virus will be related to the economic shutdown, recession, and whatnot. So I think that in the coming months, we will see some major fallout from this, and I'm not sure what we could have done differently. Many people will argue this. I think that it's not necessarily worth thinking about what could have, should have been done, but just how we move forward in a positive manner. So I hope you are all staying healthy and happy. In the podcast from last week, you can find links to all of the websites that I mentioned in that podcast. It is also on my website, carnivoremd.com. There is one particular website, coronavirus.1point3acres.com, where you can see real-time data on new coronavirus cases. If you look on the 22nd of March, the new cases were 8,333. On the 21st of March, the new cases were 7,309. So though the cases are increasing every day, there is not a the rate at which they are increasing is slowing or stable at this point, which is what we want. There is at least not an exponential rise in new cases, which is suggesting that we are doing the right things at this point. Total cases, at least yesterday, were 35,230, with a sad number of deaths of 471, which gives it less than a 2% fatality rate in the total population that has been tested. So the fatality rate for coronavirus is certainly less than 1.5. I believe it's probably less than 1. And the key now is just being aware of who is at most risk. Despite reports that coronavirus is affecting the young, I believe that most of the people who are young and being affected are immunocompromised. And though the media may report this person had no comorbidities, when I have looked into those cases as much as I could, the people did in fact have comorbidities who were profoundly affected below the age of 50 years old. So I think that in general, we do not have to fear coronavirus if we are taking care of ourselves and our families. If we have people in our lives who are susceptible to coronavirus, elderly, frail, infirm, we should protect them and try to get them some good nutrition. You guys and girls, you all know, you know what I believe to be the best source of nutrition. It would be animal foods, animal organs. I ate a lot of good animal organs this morning. I had thymus and liver myself. And you can check out my book, The Carnivore Code, for all of the details regarding that. I hope you are all doing well and staying radical. And I love you all. Please let me know how I'm doing on this podcast and leave me a review on iTunes if you can. I will talk to you soon. Stay radical, you guys.